Hello and good morning. Over the past 10 years, I think we have seen an incredible improvement of our understanding of the properties of low-mass stars in globular clusters, including their mass function. And this has been mostly possible thanks to the WIFPIC 2 camera on board the HST, which has lifted the main source of uncertainty for ground-based observations of globular clusters, namely crowding. And indeed, with the HST, looking at globular clusters has become more of a looking through globular clusters. Here is an image of the cluster NGC 6397, taken more or less at the half-light radius of this object, and you can clearly see that there are some galaxies in the background. And thanks to this camera of such a high quality, nowadays we have an impressive list of clusters for which very deep observation exists in several bands, and this list of clusters, which I put up here, is very homogeneous, physically very homogeneous, because mostly, actually, all of these objects are halo objects, and they have been observed with the WIFPIC 2, or in any case the HST, to very deep magnitudes. They share a rather similar low metallicity, and more important, they have been observed very close to the half-light radius. This will come out to be extremely important later on in my presentation. And it is, therefore, a very homogeneous sample of clusters, which we can use to hope and find information about the mass function of these objects. But even though we have the availability of the HST, looking for low-mass stars in globular clusters is still insidious, as Ivan has shown before. When it comes, for instance, to deciding which of the many hundreds of objects seen in a column magnitude like this are indeed cluster members and which instead belong to the field. In his lecture, Ivan has shown how elegantly and accurately this can be done using proper motion information. But I should like to argue here that to the point where in a column magnitude diagram such as this you can identify a ridge line for the main sequence, down to that level, already the color information is sufficient to discriminate, in a statistical sense, between field stars and cluster stars. And the fact that all these clusters have been observed in at least two or more colors or more bands makes this selection possible. Indeed, it is comforting to me that when different authors have used different techniques to analyze the same data set, the luminosity functions that have been found agree rather nicely with one another. And this, to me, is an indication as to how good the data are and how reliable the techniques which have been used to analyze the data. But even more comforting to me is the fact that when different authors, using different techniques, analyze data of different clusters, they find a rather similar result. And here you are, the luminosity functions of these 12 halo objects, which, admittedly, look remarkably similar. I'm not saying that they are identical, and I know that Ivan wants me to point this out, because of course they are not. What I should like to say, however, is that because they are so similar, and they belong to a very homogeneous sample of clusters, all of which belong into the halo, and comprising of about 10% of the population of globular clusters in our galaxy, it might be possible that by looking at these similarities, we might learn or might set some stringent, statistically important constraints as to their mass distribution. However, the most striking similarity that you see here, namely the fact that all the luminosity functions have a peak at approximately absolute magnitude 8.5 or 9 in the I band, has very little to do with the underlying mass function, and it's only due to the, mainly due to the mass-luminosity relationship. Now, I should like to spend the next 2 minutes to talk about how we convert the luminosities into masses, and about the uncertainties that are associated with this process. And unfortunately, for the clusters with such a low metallicity, we do not have nowadays an empirical mass-luminosity relationship. It only exists for solar-like stars. So we have to use models. And in the second half of the 90s, the Lyon group, led by Gilles Chabriek with the collaboration of Isabelle Baraf, has started to produce models for the atmosphere of low-mass stars, in which a non-gray approximation is used in the atmosphere of the object to provide the boundary condition for the integration towards the interior of the star. And this has shown to produce to provide models which agree rather well, we can reproduce rather well the observations, with a minimum number of adjustable parameters, as is shown here, in which the magnificent observations of NGC 6397 by Ivan King and collaborator are perfectly well fitted by the models of Baraf and collaborators. And the same is also seen in the infrared, these are data taken with NICMOS, in which again the main sequence can be fitted rather well with these models. This is however only true at low metallicity. When we go to intermediate and higher metallicity, both Ivan and Harvey Richer and collaborators have shown that the models fail to reproduce the observations. And let me show you an example of two HALO clusters that my collaborator Luigi Pulone has published recently. And you see that clearly the models fail to reproduce the feature of the main sequence in the color magnitude diagram. This shortcoming of the models is known, and it is due to a insufficient treatment of the properties of the titanium oxide molecule in the atmosphere of the stars.
What are those metallicities?
The metallicity of these objects, I'll come to them later, Fe over H is minus 0.7. However, the actual metallicity is higher. And I'll keep it here because I need to come to it later. And for solar metallicity, this problem has been more or less addressed and possibly solved now, because Los Alamos have produced improved line lists for the titanium oxide molecule. And with those, you can see the previous model's solid line now can be moved to better fit the observation of young disk stars. This improvement is important because it means that at visible wavelength, it's now possible, at least, for the model to reproduce the observations for solar metallicity. However, by using the same line lists, it's ironical, so to say, by using the same line lists, the models that before were reproducing well the observations in the infrared now do not fit anymore. And you see that these were the previous models, and then when you include the titanium oxide and water treatment, the models become worse and worse. So this is a problem that has no solution at the moment. What this author suggests is that we should possibly use the I-band for our observations, because the I-band seems to be least affected by these problems. And certainly it is so at the relatively low metallicities of the clusters, which are in the sample of those observed so far, of the HALO clusters. A nice confirmation that at least the physics on which these models are based is correct comes from recent observations taken with the VLT interferometer, the VLTI, which provided the first empirical correlation, or the first empirical relation between the mass of a star and its radius. The observations with the VLTI of nearby stars show that the models, that the black line here is the model predicted by the Lyon group for an age of 5 billion years, fits rather well the observations. Therefore, there is we can have the certainty that the physics on which the models are based is correct. So, with this caveat in mind, we can turn to their mass-luminosity relationship and try and convert the luminosity functions that have been observed, that I showed to you before, which have been observed by several... Oh, sorry. This is the radius and mass. Oh, no. Absolutely. All I said is that the physics of the interior of the star is correct. I don't know. The poor fitting in the color magnitude diagram, yes. I was simply asked by the Lyon group to show that what they are doing is not crap. So that they are doing very good things. So. And I think we owe to them. Most of the science that we have done over the past 10 years, it's thanks to the models they have put together, and others, of course, have put together. So I think it's very important to show that the physics that they put in this is correct. So if we go back to the mass-luminosity relationship, and all we need is, in practice, the derivative of the mass-luminosity relationship, which allows us to relate a luminosity function to a mass function. The way in which I like to do this, however, is start from a model mass function, such as a power law, for instance, like in this case, folded through the derivative of the mass-luminosity relationship, which is this one, and obtained a model luminosity function, which you then take and compare to the data until you find a good fit. The advantage of this way of proceeding is that you keep separate the uncertainties on the models and the uncertainty on the data. And when you do this exercise, you immediately discover that, for instance, NGC 6397, which, thanks to the work of Ivan, has so far the best luminosity function ever measured. Well, let's do this because I need. Okay. You see that in this case, a simple power law does not provide a good fit to the observation. You can use a power law to fit the rising portion of the luminosity function, one to fit the lower portion of the luminosity function, the folding one, but the two have quite different indexes. So it is as if a change of slope, a break, were needed at approximately this magnitude, which corresponds to more or less 0.3 solar masses. And indeed, there are indications that in nature, the mass function is not necessarily a power law. For instance, young clusters in the disk have an initial mass function, which is measured after 10 million years, which is a Sir-Peter power law that flattens out below 0.2 solar masses. And there are also very good theoretical reasons why the initial mass function should not be a power law. And this is, I'm referring now to the work of Bruce Elmgreen, who is in the room, I saw him before, oh, there he is, and Adams and Fatuzzo, who suggested that based on rather different theoretical approach, the mass function should have a characteristic of peak mass and a width that depends on the properties of the gas in which the stars form. Now, Bruce has suggested, for instance, that it could be the mass function should take on the form of a taper power law, that is, a Sir-Peter-like power law, for instance, which at low masses flattens out because of the insufficiency of the gravity. So the gravity is not sufficient for the star to form, and therefore the number of stars which are forming are not as many as those which are forming at higher mass. Completely different is the theoretical scenario proposed by Adams and Fatuzzo, who suggest that the mass function should take on the form of a log normal distribution, which is again characterized by a peak and a width that depends on the local properties of the gas. But in any case, I should like to point out that for globular clusters, because they only span the masses that they cover, go from 0.1 to approximately 0.8 solar masses, the two formulations are perfectly identical. And indeed, when we use either of the two for globular clusters, we find that NGC 6397, if I ever find it now, there it is. Oh, thank you, don't worry. That using either a taper power law, red line, or a log normal distribution, green line, we can fit the luminosity function rather well. And the interesting result to me is not that we can do this for NGC 6397, but that we can do it for all the clusters in the group that I showed you before, in the sample of Halo clusters. And the impressive result is that the parameters of the underlying mass functions, here they are, well, I should probably put it up, span an extremely small range around the average values. The standard deviation is less than 10%, is of order 10%. So this means that, to me, it is intriguing because it means that probably what we are seeing here gives us some indication, even more, that this sample is homogeneous. If we now look at the mass functions, and I do so only using the taper power law, simply for simplicity, and I don't want to have a clutter graph. I do this, I show you here the underlying mass functions, model mass functions, the mass function that folded through the mass-luminosity relationship reproduce the luminosity functions. And I do so in linear mass here, unit of linear mass, because I want you to see that this is basically flat at low masses. And I've plotted here vertically the average value, 0.34, of the peak or characteristic mass of these objects. And also, I've marked here, with dotted line, it's the same, it's just displaced, the average mass function for these clusters. You could ask, why on earth am I allowed to talk about average properties for these mass functions? Because I do not know that we are comparing here homogeneous quantities. We know that the clusters are physically homogeneous, but are these mass functions also homogeneous? Does it make any sense to talk about an average? Well, yes, it does, because if you remember, I mentioned that these observations were conducted near the half-light radius of the cluster, and it has been shown by several authors, Harvey Richter and Ivan King amongst them, that the mass function, the local mass function near the half-light radius, is as close as it could possibly be to the global mass function, to the mass function of the cluster as a whole. So at least we can say that these are very close to the global mass functions of the clusters. The question is, however, to which extent these global mass functions reflect the property of the initial mass functions. Is it possible that they do? Well, we know from the work of Enrico Vesperini, who is here, and also Holger Baumgart, who is in the back of the room, that the interaction of the galaxies with the clusters, integrated over the orbit and over the lifetime of the cluster, will eventually change the shape of the initial mass function by flattening it, and therefore completely masking the properties of the initial mass function from our view. So how many of these clusters have been affected? Well, we can look for this by seeing if there is any correlation between the shape of the mass function and the past dynamical history of the cluster. The past dynamical history of the cluster is well defined by a parameter, which is defined by theoreticians, which is called time to disruption, the time that it would take for the galaxy, through bulge shocking and tidal stripping, to completely destroy and disperse a cluster. And this is calculated based on the total mass of the cluster, on its space motion parameter, the orbit, and on the dynamical state. And it is very general and very comprehensive, and describes the total dynamical history of the cluster. Now, in the sample of clusters that have been observed with the HST, the Halo clusters, here they are, this time to disruption varies by almost two orders of magnitude amongst them. So there is hope that if there has been indeed a strong effect of the galaxy on the mass function of these clusters, we should be able to see it. And how do we see that? Well, I think that we should characterize somehow the matter in the following sense. Clusters which have a very long time to disruption, therefore which are least affected by the interaction with the galaxy, should have a very steep mass function. On the opposite, clusters which have been strongly affected by the interaction with the galaxy should have a much shallower mass function. We wanted to use a general as possible parameter to describe the shape of the mass function. So we simply thought that we should use a ratio, or a logarithmic ratio, so a difference in the logarithmic scale, which we call delta n, which is nothing but the ratio of the number of lower and higher mass stars measured respectively at the peak of the mass function, at the characteristic mass, so to say, and at 0.7 solar masses. This parameter is very general, makes no assumption as to what the underlying mass function form of the mass function is, whether it's a power law or whatever. It is calculated in a range where the observations are rather good. The correction, the transformation between luminosity and masses is rather reliable, because in this range, mass-luminosity relationship are good. And it is also the range in which dynamics is supposed to affect the most the mass function. So if we are looking for an effect, we should do it here. And to me,
the best place to look really would be on the other side.
It is true that it would be here, yes. But if you have noticed, for instance, what Raja has shown, the effect of strong mass segregation in the core of 47 Tucanae is extremely well visible, already at the level just below the turnoff. So I think we have to go look for a compromise and see where we can see this effect at best. But unfortunately, or surprisingly, if you want to say, I do not find any correlation when I compare these two quantities. And you see here what I define simply as a scatter diagram. If there were correlation between time to disruption and shape of the mass function, it should be of this kind. Well, if anything, there could be a correlation of the opposite type, but I think the best way to describe this graph is just saying that it's a scatter diagram. So this means that within the observational uncertainties, we see no signs of evolution with time. And within these uncertainties, we must accept that the global mass function somehow must reflect the properties of the initial mass function. So we can probably say that the initial mass function should have been already flat, more or less, have a peak or characteristic mass at 0.3 solar masses, and be flat below that. When more data are collected and the sample is increased in size, it might become possible to tell whether the differences that are clearly visible between cluster and cluster are due to a different extent of interaction with the galaxy, or whether they are due, for instance, to different conditions at birth. And indeed, there are indications that the cloud in which stars form might have effect on the mass function. And this is the last two view graphs that I'm going to show you, is seen in these observations to which I was referring before by Luigi Pulone and collaborators, amongst them myself. And these are two bulge clusters, 6496 and 6352, the only two bulge clusters for which to date there is a deep luminosity function measured with the HST. These luminosity functions here, measured as is canonical now near the half-light radius, are compared to the luminosity function of 47 Tucanae, and the reason is that in the scale of Zinn and West, as I was saying before, they have the same metallicity, Fe over h minus 0.7. It is interesting, however, that the luminosity function of 47 Tucanae is much steeper than the other two. When we try and quantify this, we can simply fold a power law distribution through the mass-luminosity relationship, which is the same for three of them, and you see that the index is, for 47 Tucanae, 1.4 versus 0.7 or 0.6 for the other two. Salpeter would be 2.35 in this case. And you can also see here that a simple power law does not fit well 47 Tucanae, but at least to this end, to approximately 0.3, between 0.3 and 0.7 solar masses, it is a good fit, and it is twice as steep. So why is this the reason? It would be very tempting to say it's, again, the effect of the interaction of the clusters with the galaxy. And the reason is bulge clusters must certainly have a much stronger interaction with the bulge itself. So if we turn to now the time to disruption for these objects, again, we find no correlation. The time to disruption for these two clusters differed by an order of magnitude. Yet they have the same luminosity function. Furthermore, for 6352, the time to disruption is longer than that of 47 Tucanae, which in turn has a longer time to disruption than 6497. Yet, 47 Tucanae is twice as steep. So we don't understand this difference. It could be, then, if we trust the models, that this very shallow mass function is not only the global mass function, but it's also the initial mass function. So why is it that the initial mass function of globular clusters in the halo is different from the one in the bulge? Well, I'm arguing now, and this is just guessing, that a possibility could have to do with binaries. In fact, in the bulge, for instance, which has a metallicity which is very similar to that of these two objects, it is expected that binaries might be as frequent as being 50% of the population. In 47 Tucanae, however, the work of Raja was just presented this morning, and the work of Mike Halbro and Ron Gilligand has shown that the number of binaries outside of the core is very small, of order of 10% or less. Why should there be a difference, then, between 47 Tucanae and these other two objects, which have the same metallicity in the scale of Zinn and West? Well, it is true that they have the same metallicity in the scale of Zinn and West, but as I said before, answering a question of Ivan's, if you look at the shape of their fiducial lines in the color magnitude diagram, you see that they are different. You see that 47 Tucanae falls off more quickly and is to the blue of the other two clusters, which indicates a lower metallicity. So although Fe over h is the same, the actual metal content is higher. Indeed, these two objects are classified as those with alpha-enhanced elements, so they are rich. Their total metallicity, M over H, is higher. So the scenario that comes out is one in which metallicity favors the formation of binaries, and this is understood if the cloud in which stars form is cold. Metallicity is very efficient at cooling off the star-forming cloud very rapidly because of the metals. And it has been shown by Sterzig and collaborators that a cold environment is conducive to a higher formation of binaries. So it could be, again, that binaries are more frequent in the bulge and in these clusters than they are in the halo clusters because of the higher metallicity. However, now we've simply moved the problem elsewhere. How come that this trend does not continue to young clusters? Young clusters have certainly a high metallicity. We know that they have quite many binaries, yet their mass function is as steep as that of halo clusters, if not even steeper. Well, I do not have an answer to this, and I had very little time to think about this, but I thought that it was probably correct to stop speculating on anything which has only based on two bulge clusters. So I think that not only should I stop now, but also my time has come to an end, and I should like to flash here a transparency that shows the points that I've addressed, and I am at your disposal for any questions that you might have. Thank you very much.
I'm sure this is going to generate lots of questions. I still ask the first one. This time to disruption, how exactly is that calculated? I mean, my impression as a theorist is that we really do not understand cluster lifetimes that well, and especially the subtleties of tidal disruption near the end of their lives.
Should I turn the no? Should no? But perhaps no. Perhaps Holger could address this question better than I can, because he has simulated.
Where did you get the?
Oh well, the numbers which were shown there come from Gnading and Ostreicher, but I also have the numbers for the work that Holger has done.
Okay, so but you didn't use my.
Yeah. Well, I can show your numbers. Sorry. Oh. Here we are. The crosses are what was done using the work of Gnading and Ostreicher, and the blue dots corresponding to the same clusters are the values as calculated by Holger.
Okay, so in principle the result doesn't change.
No, it really doesn't change. Well, again, you can probably but a straight line of this type is or probably something like this is not the type of correlation you are expecting. I don't know.
I mean, for my model.
Correctly, yes.
Yeah, I mean, I guess. Yeah,
yes, of course. For my model. Space motion parameters, yes.
Yeah,
it's an order of magnitude.
Well, the scatter is.
But my point in showing this graph was to say it's a scatter diagram. So we do not have the basis on which we can say there is a correlation between time to disruption and shape of the mass function.
Maybe if you take that one up there.
Yeah, but they go like this. So. Yes, yes. 5272 is M3. Yes.
I agree very much that these calculations of lifetimes are very uncertain, but I would like to point out that what matters for the questions we're looking at here is not the future, but it's the past.
Yes.
How much has the mass function changed since the origin of the cluster? And a few years ago, Piotto wanted to put together a program to look at the least disturbed clusters, and he got some good theoreticians. I believe it was mainly Douglas Heggie and Enrico Vesperini to choose the clusters that looked least disturbed, and two of them came up. One of them was 6254, which was the one which in your diagram had the richest low mass function.
Yes.
Much higher than your average, so that perhaps there is a correlation.
Absolutely. I think this is indeed the type of correlation for which we were looking, but I am afraid, as I said, that with the current uncertainty on the data, we cannot conclude on that.
Did you look at a plot like this, but just plotting instead of this lifetime, say, galactocentric radius?
Yes, absolutely. I didn't mention that. It's absolutely the same. This is the most complete parameter that comprehensive includes them all. This is from the center, from the plane, the dynamical state. You can plot all of them, and there is no correlation of this type.
Any other questions or comments on this? Is the follow-up on what I asked before?
It sounds like you should look at the the faint end of the, you know, from the peak of the mass function and fainter rather than the bright end. Maybe you would see a correlation there. Ivan, isn't that what you're saying, that 6254 has a rising mass function beyond that peak?
Yes.
You wouldn't see that in this plot because you're looking
at the... Yes, but we have to be reliable. So that's the range where the observations are least reliable, and certainly the mass luminosity relationship is most uncertain. So.
First of all, you said that all these mass functions are calculated near the half mass radius. From the table you showed,
Seemed
you must have done some correction for the
For three of them, it's true.
Only, okay.
There are three of them for which, if I can find the same.
How did you correct for?
We used the Michi-King multi-mass models because observations such as those of Ivan or of Harvey or our own observations seem to indicate that that they are reliable. But let me show you which one they are, and they are not the clusters which depart the most. So it's 63, 41, 70, 99, and 70. Here you are. See, for three objects, the observations were taken at 3.6, 4.5, and four objects. These four objects here, and it's they are not the ones that depart the most.
Well, you'd be worried also at 1.6, 1.8. I mean, it's near the half mass range.
But that is the value of the position of the center of the WIFPIC 2.
Yeah,
and study a much wider.
The correction
range
is probably relevant also for those. And the other thing is, as Ivan mentioned, Piotr and Zoccoli a few years ago showed that the slope of the mass function for a sample of cluster was correlated with the distance from the galactic center with the disruption time.
Yes.
And how do you reconcile these two results?
There is a paper by Holger Baumgart, which appeared on AstroPH a month ago, which shows the same even with these calculations. What I'm arguing is that the x, the exponent of the mass function, is not a good indicator of the shape of the mass function.
Why is that?
Because the mass function is not fitted by a power law.
Well, you said that in the range of 0.8, 0.3, it was a power law. Then there was a change in the slope. But my understanding was that it was multi-component power law. But in the range you would use the delta.
But the numbers that Gianpaolo Piotto and Manuela Zoccoli use is just one single number that fits the whole mass function all the way through. I was talking to Holger and I had to check this.
I think it's for a limited range of mass. It's not for that.
No, it goes all the way through to the last data point.
I would like to comment on a completely different area, and that is the fitting with the work of the Lyon group. I'm extremely pleased to see this mass radius relation confirmed so well, because we have looked at, of course, the 6397, where the color magnitude diagram fits well. But then you get to M4, where it does not fit in our data, because our data were taken with F555W, and there is a tremendous difference between the color magnitude diagram that you get with 555 and the color magnitude diagram that you get with 606. A cluster of similar metallicity, M22, has an AstroPH paper by Albro et al., and at that metallicity, using 606 rather than 555, they get an excellent fit. The problem is in the V atmospheres.
Yes.
And it appears that V is the worst possible band to use of all the ones that we use. And if you're using V, accidentally 606, which one would think being wider would be worse, it accidentally gives better results. But I like your idea of using the I band, which is much less disturbed.
Thanks.
Last question I will ask to you and maybe the star formation people here. You're trying to make a case that maybe the IMF really is different in different clusters. However, my vague impression of the field elsewhere, outside of clusters, is that whenever people have carefully determined IMFs from observations of in many different environments, there doesn't seem to be that much variation.
Well,
is that a wrong impression? Maybe Kathy Clark or somebody else?
Yeah, well, a lot of the claims of the IMF as universal are using probes that are only sensitive to the high mass end of the mass function. So looking at things like element ratios, which tells you about the there's a saltpeter tail up in the regime of supernova progenitors. What is the sort of becoming a sort of standard picture promoted by Richard Larson, for example, is that one always expects a high mass power law, but that physical conditions in different places may affect the mass at which that flattens out. So obviously it's only studies of very low mass, which studies of systems where you can probe the very low mass end that could possibly show such evidence. And so globular clusters are also obviously a prime place to do that in.